Let's open to the book of Zechariah. Zechariah in chapter 14. And we'll continue something we started last Lord's Day, speaking of the millennial river. We've been doing a little series on millennial places and things. Things that ought to be important to us, since we'll be there and see all of this. It's a wonderful thing that the Lord gives a preview, so it's more than just an encouragement to Israel. It's also an encouragement to us and gives us an idea of what that period of time will be like. And of course, we looked at the mountain of the Lord's house to begin with, and then the millennial temple. And then, with particular interest, we looked at this millennial river because it speaks of so much. And once again, this is an entirely new thing. There has been no river flowing out from the threshold of the temple at any time in the past. And that would be Solomon's temple, Zerubbabel's temple, or Herod's temple. But in the millennial temple, as we talked about before, there will be a huge upheaval geologically during the time of Jacob's trouble that precedes this period of time that we're looking at, where the entire topography of the earth will have been changed. It will be somewhat akin to what happened during and after the flood. The topography of the earth was completely changed after the flood. And I know, and I've heard people ask, well, where Adam and Eve's grave? Well, if you stop and think about that, how could you know? The topography of the earth was completely changed. People have gone in search of the Garden of Eden. Well, if the Garden of Eden is anywhere near where they think it is, which would be the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, well, that looks pretty deserty. It doesn't look like any garden ever grew there that was worthy of the name. Why? Because it's not the same. The topography of the earth was completely changed. And as a matter of fact, I don't think we could say for certain that Hiddekel and Euphrates are the same rivers that they were before the flood. They have the same names, but they may not even be in the same geologic location as they were before. Now, is there evidence that there was? Yes, there was a garden there. As a matter of fact, after the flood, when the topography of the earth had been changed, we find evidences of creatures on mountaintops that, so far as we know, there was never any water before. And so I think we can say that, we don't know where the Garden of Eden was, and even if we did, it's not very important. Well, what about this river? When you stop and think about how far the Dead Sea is below the level of the Mediterranean Sea today, you would have to think that if there were ever a river that connected those two together, the result would be that there'd be a huge flood in the Dead Sea area because all the waters of the Mediterranean would run into it. And yet we find out that this river that we're talking about feeds both of those bodies of water, the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean. So we can see that some enormous things have taken place. In fact, in the book of Revelation, that last great earthquake, we see that all the cities of the nations fell. That's one powerful earthquake. That's a global geologic upheaval. And so the topography of the earth, after it changes, is going to support this river now that now issues out from the temple where no river had previously ever been. And not surprisingly, Zechariah has something to say about that. And so let's start reading in chapter 14 then, and verse number 1. Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations, as when he fought in the day of battle. And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof, and the east toward the west, and there shall be a very great valley, and half of the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south. And ye shall flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach unto Azal. Yea, ye shall flee there as you fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and the day of the Lord shall come, and all the saints with thee. And it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light. And it shall be in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea, and half toward the hinder sea, in summer and winter it shall be. And the Lord shall be king over all the earth in that day. There shall be one Lord, and his name one. And I think we can stop here because our purpose has been attained. And the reason that I read from verse number 1 and following is because there are those that claim that all of these things happened in 70 AD and we're now in the millennium. You'll remember the preterist position that some Protestants have subscribed to, and so they would look at that and say, well, that happened in 70 AD, but no, what happened in 70 AD was just a shadow and type of what is coming yet in our future, because when Jerusalem fell under the heel of the Romans, the Lord's feet had not stood upon the Mount of Olives in the way that it's described here. Yes, he did stand upon the Mount of Olives during his earthly ministry, but not as the way it's described here, because this huge geologic upheaval that I spoke of will have been accomplished. And so we know this has to be yet in our future. If we're familiar with the topography of the environs of Jerusalem today, we know that it isn't anything like what's being described here. And the interesting thing here is its fountains of living waters. Look at verse number 8. And you notice I accentuated the words "that day" several times as I read this passage of Scripture. Verse number 8 again. And it shall be in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea and half of them toward the hinder sea. In summer and winter it shall be. In other words, this will be a year-round thing that is to happen. And so we see these living waters now flow into the Dead Sea and into the Mediterranean Sea, and they're living waters. Well, that's an interesting term that Zechariah uses here, living waters. I wonder if there's any other hint in the scriptures as to what this might mean. Well, last week, if you'll remember, we looked at one of them, but this morning, let's go to Ezekiel chapter 47. Ezekiel and chapter 47. Again, we remember that Ezekiel describes in great detail the millennial temple. Ezekiel chapter 47. Ezekiel chapter 47, verse number 6. Now, this is the end of the description of the river, how that it gets deeper and deeper until Ezekiel says, I couldn't pass over it because it'd be over my head. And then in verse number 6, and he said unto me, Son of man, seest thou this? And he brought me and caused me to return to the brink of the river. Now when I had returned, behold, the bank of the river, there were very many trees on the one side and on the other. Then said he unto me, These waters issue out toward the east country and go down into the desert and go into the sea, which being brought forth to the sea, the waters shall be healed. And it shall come to pass that everything that liveth, which moveth whithersoever the river shall come, shall live. And there shall be a great multitude of fish, because those waters shall come hither, for they shall be healed, and everything shall live whither the river cometh. And it shall come to pass that the fishers shall stand upon it from En-Gedi even to Eglam, and they shall be a place to stretch forth nets. Their fish shall be according to their kinds, as the fish of the great sea, exceeding many. So the Dead Sea is going to teem with life like the Mediterranean does. And the idea that there would be fish in the Dead Sea, well, that wouldn't occur to anybody that's ever went wading in the Dead Sea. It's a dead pool of the densest salt water on the face of the earth. So dense that it's impossible to drown in it. You float. That's an amazing thing for somebody that wants to learn how to swim. But, of course, when you come out, you'll be completely encrusted with salt, so it might not be the best idea, although people do it. But the idea of fish living in there would seem so strange, and yet the scripture says when all is said and done here, it's going to teem with life. Those waters shall be healed because they're living waters. They're not just ordinary old water as we think about it. And isn't it something how we start thinking water is mundane because there's so much of it around? But take the physical water that we know today and take it away for a day and see how we deal with that. So we're talking about living waters here. Let's go to Zechariah chapter 4. Zechariah chapter 4. We'll look at something else here that I think is so interesting. Zechariah chapter 4. Let's look at verse number 1. And the angel that talked with me came again and walked with me as a man that is wakened out of sleep, and said unto me, What seest thou? And I said, I have looked, and behold, a candlestick all of gold, with a bowl upon the top of it, and his seven lamps thereon, and seven pipes to the seven lamps, which are on the top thereof, and two olive trees by it, one on the right side of the bowl, and the other on the left side thereof. So I answered and spake to the angel that talked with me, saying, What are these, my lord? Now we talked about that golden, or that brazen sea in the temple before. Here's the golden candlestick. Verse 5. Then the angel that talked with me answered and said unto me, Knowest thou not what these be? And I said, No, my lord. Then he answered and spake unto me, This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel, saying, Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts. Who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel thou shalt become as a plain, and thou shalt bring forth the headstone thereof with shoutings, crying, Grace be unto it. Well, this is interesting. We have a vision here that has to do with the temple and the golden candlestick, which is the hint there. And then we find out here that this mountain before Zerubbabel was to be cast down, and there was going to be a great plain. Well, that's interesting. I wonder if that has a connection with anything else. But wasn't it interesting that verse number 6 precedes verse number 7? Have we ever heard this quoted? I think we probably have, and we should have. Look at the quotation at the end of verse number 6. This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel, saying, remember, Zerubbabel's the one that's building that temple. After they come back into the land, Zerubbabel and Nehemiah, they set about to reconstruct the Lord's house. And what does he say? It won't be done by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts. Well, the very fact that Zerubbabel and Nehemiah are in the land, what's immediately striking you about that? How is it that they get back here? They've been down in Babylon now. And what has happened that you would have to say, this is an act of God? Remembering now these four successive empires, what empire comes after Babylon?
The Medes and the Persians.
Now, when the Medes and the Persians take over, where's Israel?
They're still in captivity.
Interesting. But then a certain king arises, and he gets some interesting information. Yes, it's Cyrus, the king of Persia. Mm-hmm. He finds out that Daniel has had something to say about him before he was born. Mm-hmm. I knew your name before you were born. You're going to do something. You're going to let my people go. Pharaoh didn't, but you're going to do it, and he does. Not only that, he finances the expedition to get some of the children of Israel out of Babylon, who've gotten so comfortable down there, they don't even want to go back. And Cyrus gives them the funding to go and helps to fund the new temple that they're going to build. No, it's not by might and not by power, but it's by the Spirit of the Lord. Okay, keeping that in mind, let's go to Mark chapter 11. There's something there that if you connect these two things, you say, oh, now I get it. I think they call that an epiphany. Mark chapter 11, and we'll start reading in verse number 12. And on the morrow, when they were come from Bethany, he was hungry, Jesus. And seeing a fig tree afar off having leaves, he came as if haply he might find anything thereon. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for the time of figs was not yet. Remember that. And Jesus answered and said unto it, no man eat fruit of thee hereafter forever. And his disciples heard it. And they came to Jerusalem, and Jesus went into the temple and began to cast out them that sold and bought in the temple, and overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seat of them that sold doves, and would not suffer that any man should carry any vessel through the temple. And he taught, saying to them, is it not written, my house shall be called of all nations an house of prayer, but you've made it a den of thieves? And the scribes and chief priests heard it and thought how they might destroy him, for they feared him because the people, and was astonished at his doctrine. But when even was come, he went out of the city. And in the morning, as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up by the roots. And Peter, calling to remembrance, saith unto him, Master, behold, the fig tree which thou cursest is withered away. And Jesus answering said unto them, have faith in God. For verily I say unto you, that whomsoever shall say unto this mountain, be thou removed and be thou cast into the sea, and shall not doubt in his heart, But he shall believe those things which he saith shall come to pass. He shall have whatsoever he saith. Therefore, I say unto you, what things soever you desire, when you pray, believe that you receive them, and ye shall have them. Do you think that them here is something in particular that he's talking about? It was just a rhetorical question. Obviously, it's in the context of what he's just got done saying. So let's sum up in our minds what has happened here. Jesus has left Bethany. He's on the way to Jerusalem. He spots a fig tree. Now, most of us know what the fig tree symbolizes in the scriptures, which would be Israel. Yes. And it's interesting, when he comes up to this fig tree, in verse number 13, he finds nothing but leaves, but look at the last part of verse number 13. For the time of figs was not yet. Do you suppose Jesus knew that it wasn't time for figs? Do you suppose that he knew there weren't any figs on that fig tree? Do you think that this might have some other meaning than, I wanted figs and there are no figs, and so I'm going to curse this tree, just on general purposes? No, there's a whole lot more to it than just that. And it's interesting, in verse number 14, Jesus says to the fig tree, no man eat fruit of thee hereafter forever, and his disciples heard it. Oops. If his disciples had been spiritually astute, what would they have understood Jesus to say? This nation has nothing for you. Okay, then they go to enter Jerusalem, and Jesus goes into the temple, and what does he find? The very reason that he said, this nation has nothing for you. Notice that he says, my house shall be called of all nations a house of prayer. The first thing they did was put the Gentiles out, and then they didn't suffer themselves even to go in. And that system had no fruit. But the time of figs was not yet. Interesting. Do you think the scribes and chief priests knew what he was doing? Verse number 18. And when the scribes and chief priests heard it, they sought how they might destroy him. Why? Because he was attacking the very basis of their false religion. They were being exposed for the hypocrites and criminals that they really were. So they're going to do away with him. Well, even comes and he goes out of the city. Isn't it interesting? It's evening when he goes out of the city. Verse 20, and in the morning, as they passed by, same path, they saw the same fig tree, but it's dried up by the roots. Peter sees that and says, hey, look, Lord, that tree you cursed, it's dead. I'm not sure Peter understands what's going on either. But look what Jesus says. This is interesting. Verse 21, and Peter, calling to remembrance, saith unto him, Master, behold, the fig tree which thou cursest is withered away. And Jesus answering saith unto him, have faith in God. That seems like a strange answer to what Peter has said. Jesus doesn't say, well, yeah, I noticed that myself. No, he says something that on the surface it seems out of context. Have faith in God. Because the fig tree's dead?
But he's talking about Israel.
Yes, of course. They're going to remember this later. For verily, verse 23, I say unto you that whosoever shall say unto this mountain, be removed and be thou cast into the sea, and shall not doubt in his heart, but shall believe those things which he saith shall come to pass, he shall have whatsoever he saith. Couple of things here. This mountain, which mountain do you suppose he was talking about? since he's practically standing on it. Yeah, that's interesting. Be removed and be cast into the sea? That sounds like a huge geographic upheaval, doesn't it? And then what does he say? If you'll say it and believe in your heart that it's going to come to pass, you'll get to have it. You don't suppose he's talking about what Zechariah was talking about, do you? In that day, he's talking about the fall and the rise again of Israel. Don't you suppose those disciples later would read this in the book of Mark and say, oh, that's what he's talking about? Now we have the book of Revelation and all the pieces of the puzzle fit together perfectly. Wow. That's a message of encouragement to us too, isn't it? But the Bible is just a collection of myth and fallacy. How cleverly contrived, a book of myth and fallacy, indeed. Let's pray.